Hello, my name is John Smetanka. The name of our program is With Respect. Today's guest in With Respect is a guest from a prior show, which is extremely interesting, what he's going to be talking about today. It's John Shulian, who is a nationally recognized sports writer and commentator for many years. And we've talked about the fascinating people he met in the world, for example, of boxing and other sports. Today, we're going to be talking about a different area of his life, sort of a radical change, and that is his work in Hollywood. John Shulian, With Respect. John, how are you today?
Well, I'm upright, so that counts for something, I hope.
It does, actually. It does keep away the Undertaker, and it keeps away flies, I suppose. I don't know. It's a good time to be standing upright. So, John, we talked last time about your background, how you got into writing, how you got into journalism, sports, both as an actor, a player, and also later on as a writer, giving all kinds of openings and to meeting interesting people and learning, for example, the area of boxing. But today I'd like to talk about how did you go out in Hollywood? How did you end up in Hollywood, which is where you ended up, where you're at now? Tell us about that. Where did you, what happened? What taught you the lesson is you need to go out to Hollywood after dealing with boxers and basketball players and baseball players.
Well, I'd learned how to take a lot of punishments over the years. So if a writer wants to be punished, he comes to Hollywood. So I was right around, I made the decision on the night of my 40th birthday. Excuse me. I had covered a 76ers basketball game in Philadelphia. I was working as a sports columnist at the Philadelphia Daily News at the time. And my subject for the evening was Moses Malone, who was not very communicative when I interviewed him. So I just went back and winged it. And so I'm driving home through a snowstorm, and I'm thinking, I'm 40 years old, and I'm still interviewing naked men about the games they just played. They're of no great import, really. And I'm tired of bumping heads with coaches. The athletes are becoming harder and harder to talk to. The newspaper business was just beginning to change. I mean, the newspapers have been dying for a long time, and they were simply picking up steam, as we've seen the evidence scattered around our country. I said, I've got to do something else for a living, or try to, at least. And then I said, well, what's the one thing I can do in life? I can write. So where can I write if it's not for a newspaper or a magazine? Hollywood. Sure, I can do that. I can at least try. So anyway, I reached out to a friend who had stayed in touch with a woman we'd worked with in Chicago. And she'd come to work at the L.A. Times as a photographer. And she had married a TV writer, a bright young man named Jeff Melvoin, Harvard-educated, wonderful guy. And I got on the phone with Jeff Melvoin, and he gave me 45 minutes of his time, which is an eternity by Hollywood standards. And he was warm and funny and receptive and smart. And he said, well, when we really hit it off on the phone, he said, well, the next time you come to L.A., I want you to give me a call and we'll get together for dinner. So I covered the Hearns-Hagler fight, classic fight, greatest fight I ever covered, in April of 1985. And then I called Jeff Melvoin and said, I'm coming to L.A. Tomorrow. And he said, well, great, I've been waiting for you. At 10 in the morning, you're going to go meet a vice president at MTM Films, which was then the hottest TV production company in the business. They were doing Hill Street Blues, Mary Tyler Moore, St. Elsewhere. And then in the afternoon, you're going to go meet the head of development at Geffen Films. So, and both of those meetings went swimmingly. And then Jeff and I went to dinner that night. And while we're talking, he's explaining to me, he said, everybody gets into Hollywood a different way. There is no one set path. And I was about to discover that. And I was incredibly lucky. So I said, what if I wrote Stephen Bochco a letter and just introduced myself and see what he thinks about my chances? And Jeff said, do it. Stephen Bochco, for those who don't remember him, was the creator of Hill Street Blues, or co-creator with Michael Kozol of Hill Street Blues, a show that really revolutionized television storytelling. Handheld cameras, constant movement of the camera, multiple storylines in one-hour episodes. Brilliant show. It was the beginning of a wonderful change in television that I think that you saw the most recent example of what Hill Street's children have wrought would be The Wire, which to my way of thinking is the greatest television series ever. Anyway, I was getting ready to go cover Wimbledon in 85, so I wrote Stephen a letter, sent him a copy of a book I'd done, a collection of my boxing stories, and a profile of Mike Royko, the great Chicago newspaper columnist that I'd written for GQ. Went off to Wimbledon, came home, found a letter from Bochco saying that he got my book and he promised to read it, but he wanted me to know that a lot of journalists think they can write for the screen, but a lot of journalists can't. But if I was still interested, to let him know, and he'd send me some Hill Street scripts to study. So I wrote back and said, nobody in newspapers or magazines had ever answered a letter of mine as quickly as he did. Please send the scripts. And then I went off on vacation for a couple of weeks. And I came home, and here was a large envelope with three Hill Street scripts and a letter from Bochco that now hangs on the wall here in my office. And it says basically, dear John Shulian, you're a terrific writer. If you can't write for the screen, I'll be surprised and disappointed. And if I ever get this show about lawyers off the ground, I'll have you come out and write a script for money. P.S. You type great. I didn't spot a single do-over in your letter. And Stephen had just left Hill Street Blues and was now at 20th Century Fox, and he was developing the series that you may have heard of, L.A. Law.
I have, yeah.
And he was working with a former lawyer named Terry Louise Fisher. And almost a year to the day after I received that letter, I was out in his office in the old writer's building at Fox, on the Fox lot, in a story meeting about the script that I was going to write. I was going to write the 9th episode of L.A. Law. And I was utterly petrified. I went in there. I was in so far over my head. I did not know TV writing. I did not know the law. I couldn't even give you my name, rank, and serial number at that point. But after I sat there paralyzed for 5 or 10 minutes, I thought to myself, dummy, what have you always done when people smarter than you were talking? You take notes. And so I took notes all day about the different things that would happen in this episode, an episode about a trust fund for the poor people of Beverly Hills. And at the end of the day, Stephen showed me what's called a beat sheet. It's a scene-by-scene outline of what will be in the script itself. And it's going to be fairly detailed. They can be short, they can be long. Mine was going to be as detailed as I could make it because I did not want to work without Annette. And I'm pretty sure Stephen didn't want me to either. So if I didn't deliver the goods, he would still have something to rely on as a guidepost for the next writer up. So I came back a couple days later with my beat sheet. We went over it. We made some changes. Change is a constant player in screenwriting. You're always making adjustments, it seems. And so Steve was taking a flyer on three untested TV writers at this time. One of them was a woman whose name I forget. And there was me, the sports writer from Philadelphia. And lastly was a young lawyer from Boston named David Kelly, who any devout TV watcher will be able to tell you did Ally McBeal, Boston Legal, Picket Fences, on and on. I mean, and he married Michelle Pfeiffer in the bargain. So David did quite well.
What's wrong with that life?
So now I see how Stephen had got the script from the female member of our trio of budding TV writers, and it was not a good experience for him. And I saw how deflated he was. And I said, look, I don't want to waste your time or mine. I said, what if I go off and I write six of the scenes from the episode we had worked on, my episode, and if you like them, I'll proceed and do the rest of the script. And if you don't like them, I will part as friends. And he said, that's fine. So I went off. Every night I was staying someplace different to see if I'd stay at friends' apartments, I was using up all my Hyatt hotel points I garnered over the years traveling as a sports writer. And I worked on these six scenes for, I'd say, 2 or 3 days. And then came back on a Friday afternoon, gave them to Stephen, and he said he promised he'd call me, let me know what he thought of them. So the next day was a Saturday, so I was out horsing around in L.A., came back to my friend's apartment, saw the message light blinking, played the message, and it was Bochco. And he said, I don't know what you're doing hanging around with sports writers, kid. You're in show business.
Mm-hmm.
And I was in show business. I went back to Philadelphia. I finished writing the script from there in the middle of the script. My dad died. I dealt with that. Bochco was just totally cool with everything. He was so supportive. I owe him a great debt. I owe many people in the course of my various careers a debt. I've always had incredibly good luck finding people or being found. People who encouraged me and gave me the room to do what I needed to do. And Stephen died a few years ago of brain cancer. He was really a wonderful guy to me.
Wow. That's a fascinating progression. And I can understand people in our audience who are saying, well, I could never do that. I could never make that jump. I would be scared to death. But you were. As an ordinary, scared to death human being taking a big jump in their life, and just like ordinary people, you being a superstar, of course you're not ordinary, but ordinary people come to different points in their lives and they're confronted with the big leap. It's kind of the Kierkegaardian leap of faith. Can I take this big step? Can I make it, or am I going to fall in the cliff, down the cliff, and die? And it's the leap of faith, the trust that you're either your ability or the need of the other people around you, or the intervention, the divine intervention that you're gonna succeed. We're gonna take a break right now. We'll come back. We're gonna talk more about how you took advantage of these chances that you were given and what you did with them and your future career. This is John Smetanka. We're talking to John Shulian, not only an eminence grise in the sports world, but also in Hollywood. And he's just taken the step to work with Stephen Bochco and various programs that we're going to find out how many we know of. We'll be talking with him in just a minute after we take a break. This is With Respect, and this is John Smetanka. We'll be right back. We're now back on With Respect with John Shulian, sports writer, sports columnist, and now we find him in a wholly different world, the world of Hollywood and television and whatever else is out there. This is John Smetanka, and this is With Respect. So, John, you took the big step. You use your default mechanism, which you took notes and you paid attention to other people and to events around you. But you're now been told by one of the great Hollywood TV personalities, and dominant person, Steve Bochco, that you're now an entertainment writer. What happened from there?
Well, I went off. My hand had been held throughout the L.A. Law Experience by a young writer. Everybody was at least 10 years younger than I was. I was, I think, 41 when I came out here. So right away I saw a headline in Variety saying, writers over 40 can't get work in TV. And I thought, holy smokes, I'm dead on arrival. But as it turned out, middle-aged guys, people, writers, not guys, I can't say guys anymore because there are many, many wonderful female writers who've always done good work out here, great work. I had a young fellow named Jacob Epstein, who was a wonderful guy, very, very smart. He'd worked on Hill Street Blues and come over to L.A. Law with Bochco. Jacob and I hit it off, became good friends, and he was lobbying hard for me to get on staff. He tried to convince Bochco that I could do it. And I knew in my heart of hearts that I would certainly have tried it if the job had been offered to me, but I would have been overmatched. So as it turned out, Stephen said, Stephen being very smart and canny enough to realize what I knew about myself too, said he'd send me over to Universal to work with a guy who was his mentor, a wonderful Hollywood character named Bill Sackheim. So I went over there, but before Sackheim and I could get anything going, I get a call from Jacob Epstein, and he said, in 2 hours, Miami Vice is going to call you. They're doing a two-parter, which is two episodes back-to-back, about boxing. And I told them about you, and I think you'll be perfect. So the phone rings 2 hours later. It's a guy named Mike Duggan, who I'd met at Jacob's 30th birthday party. And he said, come on over. So I went over. And I met a young writer producer who was running the writing staff at Miami Vice, Dick Wolf, who went on to create the Law and Order franchise. And every week there's a dump truck full of money that just pulls up to his house and dumps it in the driveway, I guess. But they were doing these two episodes on boxing. So he had a beat sheet already. He said, go over this and tell me what you think. And I said, well, this would be a little bit different, and that just wouldn't happen. And we made 3 or 4 changes. And then he said, okay, it's Saturday afternoon, and we need a script by Tuesday. And I said, okay. And he said he would write acts 1 and 4, and I would write acts 2 and 3, and we would be on Tuesday. So I once again went to the hotel I'd stayed at a lot, a place called Le Parc, and wrote my 2 acts and gave them to Dick, and he liked them, and we got them off. And we were putting together simply a script that you could do location scouting and casting and those sort of things as part of pre-production. Then Dick and I went back and polished up the script a great deal, and it turned out to be two pretty good episodes. We used Don King as a boxing promoter, much like himself. We used Mark Breland, the old Olympic champion, and we used Randall Tex Cobb, who is notorious mainly for fighting Larry Holmes and not landing a punch, I think. But Tex was wonderful in this, and Tex was always also in Raising Arizona and all kinds of things. And he became the first man I killed on television. So
I'm sure his family appreciated that.
Well, they appreciate the check or the residual check. And then Dick, well, I remember Dick Wolf walked into my office where I was temporarily lodged there in building 69 at Universal. And he said, I don't know where you learned how to do this, but you know how to get into a scene and out of a scene. And so we did the second half of the two-parter. And the next thing I knew, I was on staff. They hired me as a staff writer with a bump up to story editor after I'd been around for a few episodes. And my trajectory went something like this. In June of 1986, I was a sports columnist at the Philadelphia Daily News with no television writing credits or experience. I had never written a script in my life. And by December of 1986, I had writing credits I had 3 writing credits on 2 of the hottest shows in television. I had my L.A. Law episode, which Bochco had rewritten significantly, and then it made it incredibly better than what I had done. But he made sure that I got full payment for the script. And then I did the 2 episodes with Dick, and then I sat down to write my first maiden voyage, or my first solo effort, rather. And there we were. We were off to the races. And I would tell this, people would ask me how I got into business. And I would tell them this story that I'm telling you now. And they would just shake their heads in wonderment, because I worked with really, really wonderful writers. And there were guys who had spent 10 years working as pool men to keep their head above water, no pun intended. One guy had been an assistant golf pro for a while. Somebody else was an electrical engineer. Lots of ex-lawyers come to write work in Hollywood and write for the screen, both the big screen and little screen. But my story sort of took the cake as far as being unlikely. I mean, I think it's, it was just something I had to do, though, John. If I was not happy working in Philadelphia, I was recently divorced. There were many, many things going on in my life. And I think I always felt that if I had failed making the jump to Hollywood, I wasn't going to hurt anybody but myself. I was not married. I had no children. And I was the only one who was going to get scuffed up. And if I did, I would simply pick myself up, dust myself off, and go back to work in newspapers and magazines.
Well, you know, one of the things that was happening at the same time was that your possible paymasters in journalism were dying, the media. The newspapers were beginning to take financial and journalistic hits, and have been to this day. So I would imagine that you were kind of ahead of the wave, and riding that rode you out to Hollywood, and behind that wave was maybe not so big a market.
Yeah, it was, you know, I mean, I think some people in newspapers gave me credit for being able to see all that. and I certainly didn't. I didn't think, well, the newspaper business is shrinking. But I would, after I had come out here and you know, settled down, bought a home, and it was getting good work on good shows. Then people would say, well, you really had it figured out. I said, I didn't have anything figured out. I just wanted to try it. I mean, I've always been fascinated by movies. My dad used to take me to a second-run theater when I was a kid here in L.A. And, you know, I was watching Stagecoach and His Girl Friday and... you know, the Big Sleep. I was watching movies like that when I was 10 years old. I was getting an education in film without even realizing it.
Front Page? Did you watch Front Page?
I've never seen Front Page, but I've seen, you know, His Girl Friday, which is the
same
the
thing
screen with Cary Grant and Ralph Bellamy and Rosalind Russell. Is it Rosalind Russell? Am I blanking?
Yep. Well, you know, this is interesting because I am sure that those of us who have been riding our own waves of what is possible, what am I good for, what can I do, and those of us who have come to, as I have, a blank wall and said, you know, I remember the first blank wall that I came to that I can recall was I had to handle an appeal. A habeas corpus case for a guy who I had believed, and I still believe, and it was verified, didn't commit the crime that he committed, that he was convicted for. And the reason I mention this is because I was happy to work as an investigating attorney, putting the case together that he didn't do it. But at one point I came to having to file a habeas corpus in federal court, which I had never done. From the side of a petitioner. I answered some of them, but at any rate, I tried to find anybody I could to write it for me, to take the case, and they wouldn't. No one took it. So I decided, took heart in mouth and fate in hand, and I did it, and we were successful eventually. It took us some years. But the point here is we all come to those points when... It's, do I take the leap? Do I take the jump? This world that I'm facing is something I haven't done before, and I haven't been in before, and so now what do we do? And so this whole story to this point is very familiar to many of us, many of us. Anyway, we're going to take a break right now. When we come back, we're going to talk about individual shows and different people that you came across. You've already talked about some interesting folks, but there's a lot more to talk about. This is John Smetanka. We're talking to John Shulian, and this is On With Respect. We're talking about his leap from being a sports writer par excellence into a Hollywood screenwriter. And we'll find out more after that. This is With Respect, and we'll be right back. Now back on With Respect with John Shulian, a great sports writer and sports columnist nationally. And now we're talking about his work as a screenwriter, apparently with no logical connection. But life has made it work for him. So this is John Smetanka. So now you've been called upon to try something that you had never done before. You have been given mentors. Life has given you some mentors who you impressed and they impressed you with shaping your future. You've done in that period from January until I think it was December, you've accomplished so much. And now what happens? You're on your way. And you've got a filmography. You've got a book of business, as we would say in the law.
Well, it's a job, and I had so much to learn. There are things I wish I'd done differently. I wish I'd paid more attention to certain aspects of the business, not the things that didn't have so much to do with writing as they did with just the post production and that sort of thing, but. I stayed with Miami Vice. I finished season 3. I think I did the last 13 episodes on Vice out of an order of 22. Then we started season 4, and I wrote the season, what was supposed to be the season premiere. I'm not sure if it was or not, but it was Ryan Dennehy, and he played a crooked TV evangelist, if you can imagine that. it turned out to be a good episode. But then I blew out my back, and I wound up in the hospital for a couple of weeks. And when I came back, Dick Wolf had been fired, a mistake that was soon righted, and they brought Dick back and had to pay him an inordinate amount of money. But I didn't know that I wanted to go back to that. I wanted to try something different. So I went to work on a show called The Slap Maxwell Story. And Slap was, of all things, a sports columnist, played by Dabney Coleman, a wonderful actor. You may remember as the boss in 9 to 5. The girls, Jane Fonda, Dolly Parton, and Lily Tomlin, tied to the ceiling fan and have him spinning around on it.
I remember it.
And Dabney was a difficult case. I remember one day we did a little location shooting, which was not very common on half-hour comedies. We were a dramedy, so maybe that made a difference. But Dabney came up to me, and he said, John, I said, yes, Dabney. He said, this here at the bottom of page 17, this is a joke. I said, yes, because I wrote it because we're supposed to make things, people laugh occasionally in this dramedy. And he said, I don't do jokes, fix it. So I fixed it. I made it as unfunny as I possibly could. And we finished that episode. Everybody with a smile on his face. So Slap only lasted the 1 year. But when I worked at Slap, I worked for a wonderful comedy writer, a real genius, a guy named Jay Tarsis, who had created a series called Buffalo Bill a few years earlier with Dabney Coleman starring in it. And they had hated each other by the time it was over. And yet when Dabney got a guarantee of 13 episodes on the air, he said he wouldn't do it. From ABC, he said he wouldn't do them unless he had Jay Tarsis working. So anyway, that was a great experience. For more unique reasons than the LA Law thing or the Miami Vice thing. Every show has its own dynamics and personality and mood, I guess. It's funny, and I bounced around a lot. So then I went from Slap to Wise Guy, which was a very well-regarded series, remembered mainly maybe for the Mel Prophet episodes where Kevin Spacey and Joan Severance played brother and sister, crooks, of course. And I did the second season of Wise Guy, which was, we did a five-part arc on the Garment District, starring Jerry Lewis and Ron Silver and Joan Chen. And we had cast that you'd be lucky to get for a movie. It was amazing. Wise Guy was a very writerly show. A guy named David Burke ran the writing staff, and he was temperamental, not the easiest guy in the world to get along with, but lavishly talented. And we did, we did some very interesting stuff on there. And then we did a long arc on the rock and roll business. And once again, we had Debbie Harry, we had Glenn Frey from the Eagles, all of whom turned out to be able to act a little bit. We had Tim Curry from the Rocky Horror Picture Show. We had Paul Winfield, who impressed me because he walked in to meet with the writing staff and told us he had just been in New York the night before, where he'd been reading Langston Hughes at the 92nd Street Y. I thought, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, it is.
And then I went off to work on Midnight Caller, which is unfortunately not very well remembered series, but I had the best 2 years of my time in Hollywood working there. By this point, I was a co-producer and then supervising producer.
So let me take a stop just a second. You started off as a screenwriter, and then you became a script editor or a senior writer, and now you're talking about producer. Now, I've heard that so many times. I've seen it on the screen, on movies, and I've seen the screen on television. What the heck does a producer do? And how is that different than a director?
A producer, as you've no doubt figured out, is a pretty loose term that gets applied to a lot of people. In television, I won't even go into the producing thing in movies. When you see them up there to pick up an award, there's one award or one Oscar for eight guys. You think, are they going to carve it up in pieces? In TV, basically, producer can just be a writing position in TV. It can be other things, too. You can be a line producer and actually be on the set and doing the day-to-day hard work, putting in the long hours. You can be a producer, for a million reasons. You can be a producer because you're the star's agent or manager. It all happens, but when I was hired as a staff writer, which is the absolute bottom rung, this would be on Miami Vice, then I got bumped up to story editor. So when I went to Slap Maxwell, I was still a story editor, which was, I was just writing. When I went to Wise Guy, I became executive story editor. When I went to Midnight Caller, I was a co-producer. And then my second season there, I was a supervising producer. I don't know that I supervised anything. I worked with some freelance writers and worked on their scripts. You know, I was in casting sessions. I was in editing sessions. You know, I was more involved than I had been, but I wasn't worried about making the budget or doing anything like that, you know, which is the, you know, where good producers make, you know, well, this is crass, but Boschko was once talking about a guy who had worked for him at Hill Street Blues and had enormous success creating another show. And he said, he couldn't think of this guy as a producer. He said, he couldn't produce a bowel movement. So, you know, and had I been ever been in a position where I was running a show, I would have found the greatest real producer I could to come and help me. That's how I would have dealt with that problem. And then hopefully I would have learned something by working with him. So anyway, Midnight Caller, we did traditional kind of cop shows. We did romantic comedies. We did social issues. The premise of the show was our hero, Jack Killian, played by a wonderful actor named Gary Cole, was an ex-San Francisco cop who had left the force after he'd accidentally killed his partner and dived into a bottle, and then he had found a second life working as this midnight talk show host, the Nighthawk, Jack Killian. And we had wonderful, wonderful guest stars again. We had Roger Daltrey from The Who did a wonderful job for us. Levon Helm from the band. Hoyt Axton, who was a maniac country singer, played a crooked boxing promoter. Everywhere I went, I did something with boxing. You're going to do a boxing episode this year, aren't you? Yeah, okay. I'm your boy. And then you saw my first 6 years in television were really wonderful. I don't know what I did to deserve them, but I worked for wonderful people on shows that I could really get invested in and just really enjoy. For the most part, you're always going to hit some bumps in the road. But, you know, living the dream for a while. And then after Midnight Caller went off the air, I went to work on a series called Reasonable Doubts, which starred Marley Matlin, the deaf actress from Children of a Lesser God, and Mark Harmon, who's a TV star. I mean, really and truly, he's a TV star to this day with NCIS. But I just wasn't right for the show, and that became increasingly apparent. And I was a co-executive producer, so that was an awkward and difficult year. But then I was going to, you know, I left to see the show at the end of that season. They didn't have to ask me to leave. I wanted to leave. And then I was going to write a Mike Tyson movie for HBO. And I was working for a wonderful old producer named Edgar Sherrick, who had put Wide World of Sports on the air when he was running ABC TV and had produced movies like Taking of Pelham 1-2-3 and Woody Allen's Take the Money and Run. It was just a real character. I mean, you know, chewing hard candy, screaming for his assistants to come and help him, and always knowing exactly where we were in the conversation that where he and I were having. He was an astounding guy, a great mind. And as a side gig at that same time, we were doing something at Paramount, where we were trying to put The Untouchables back on the air as a TV series. that didn't go too well. And I had a difference of opinion with the guy running that writing staff. And that was the end of me there. And then they changed executives. HBO changed executives on the on the Mike Tyson movie. And I got bounced out of that. So now, for the first time in my life, I don't have a gig in Hollywood. And that's an adjustment. When you go a year and your phone doesn't ring, that's a test of something. I'm not sure what.
It does.
So I did some long pieces for Sports Illustrated. I had a relationship with GQ that started back in 1984, and I kept writing pieces for them. So I always had something in my typewriter or word processor that gave me evidence that I was still a writer. And then I had, it's funny that I had agents. Agents are a whole other story.
Well, listen.
We can do an hour about them someday.
Well, let's take a break right now, because we're going to come back, and I want to talk about another program that you are the co-producer of that everybody knows about. But we can talk about what happens during the bumps that people go through, like even persons of great talent like yourself. At any rate, this is John Smetanka, Ryan With Respect, and we're talking to John Shulian, a screenwriter, before that a boxing and sports reporter and columnist, and a wholly interesting guy. He's very human and has got his ups and downs in his very magical career. This is John Smetanka, and we will be right back. We're now back on With Respect with John Shulian, sports writer, sports columnist, magazine sports writer, script writer, co-executive producer, co-create. Wow, I can't keep track of them all. all over the United States. So this is John Smetanka, Run With Respect. So we left off and that you were going through a dry spell, which you magically filled with articles for GQ and for
GQ
various
and Sports Illustrated.
And Sports Illustrated.
Those were where I had my accounts, yeah.
So what happened from there?
Well, the interesting thing is I was represented by United Talent, which is a great agency, and I had all these macho kind of killer agents, all male, who were, when I was hot, they were always buzzing around talking about what they were going to do for me. And then when I cooled off considerably and was without a gig in television, they magically disappeared. So, but there were three female agents, women agents at UTA, and they took turns calling me and keeping my spirits up. They got me one gig doing a noir series based on stories and books that were in public domain. And I wrote a really good script, one of the few that I would dare show anybody, that I was really proud of. So they kept me afloat. Then one day, one of my agents, Nancy Jones, called and said, John, what do you think about Hercules? And I said, well, okay, let's go talk to the people who were doing Hercules. This is over at Universal. And they had done 5 one-hour movies as part of an action pack. They'd also done a science fiction thing, a martial arts thing, and I forget what the other couple were. But I went over there and I said, that I saw Hercules as a weekly series. Hercules is like a cowboy in a Western series. He's just wandering ancient Greece, looking for villagers to help and pilgrims who are being robbed and that sort of nonsense. And they fell for it. So suddenly I found myself doing syndicated TV for Sam Raimi and Rob Tappert, who really were geniuses at making movies like Army of Darkness, Evil Dead, Dark Man. They were really good at that, but they were very green as far as television went. And they had a lot of lessons to learn. I tried to teach them some of them, particularly Rob. Sam mostly was just resurrecting his career as a movie director, and which he did quite wonderfully with Spider-Man. But anyway, so I'm doing that, and then one day Rob comes to me and says he wants to do a female warrior in the hopes that she can be spun off into a series of her own. And I think, okay, well, let me see what I can do. And at the same time, I had been pitching a TV series about a boxer, and without any luck. There had been a guy at ABC who liked it, and he left the business. And it was called The Ring, and it was a family drama. You had the young boxer. You had his father, who was an ex-boxer, worked in a tannery, had a big gambling problem. His mother, who was getting ready to leave the old man because he was deep down a bum. His sister, who is the only college-educated person in the family and is trying to distance herself from them. And his brother, who's in and out of trouble with the law. And I saw it as a novel for television. 5 years, you see him go from pretender to contender to champion. You see him fall in love. You see him become a father. You see him lose his title. You see him cheat on his wife, maybe destroy his marriage. And then you see him resurrected. It was a life. And so I wrote these two scripts, the one for The Ring and the one for Hercules that introduced the female warrior. And I thought this was a turning point in my career in Hollywood. The bad news for me was it was good news initially. There was a new president of TV at the Fox Network, a fellow named John Matoyan, and he loved my script for The Ring. It was one of his two favorite scripts that year. But he couldn't get his head around two things. One, it was too bleak, and two, it was too blue collar. And I thought, well, rich kids don't fight. They don't get their noses broken willingly. And as far as bleak, I didn't understand bleak because this was about a kid chasing his dream. And that was what I was, the message that I was trying to impart in this was that it's okay to dream. You've got to have dreams. That's what keeps us going. It keeps us in the race. But, They ultimately never shot the script. And I think 10 years later, as I was on my way out of the business, I ran into one of the young executives who'd been at Fox then, and he said that he thought The Ring was the greatest pilot they never did. So, you know, what are you going to do? Meanwhile, the female warrior is cooking along, and we are going to shoot three episodes with her. I will write the first one and the third one. And a guy who I worked very closely with on her case, a fellow named Bob Belak, would do the second one. So we cast a little cupcake of an actress to play this warrior princess whose name happened to be Xena. And we cast this delicate flower named Vanessa Angel. And we sent her to horseback riding lessons and martial arts lessons. And we just wanted to butcher her up a little bit so she could look semi-believable. But she was just, I mean, she was beautiful. But I, beyond that, she didn't really strike fear in anybody's heart. So the week between Christmas and New Year's is the deadest week in Hollywood all year. There's nobody in town. And we get a call from Vanessa Angel, who's in London visiting her family, saying that she's deathly ill and she can't travel to shoot the three episodes of Hercules. You know, we're introducing her as Xena. So we are out of luck. We have nobody to play Xena. Rob and Sam know every B-movie actress in the world. And we looked at blonde Xenas and redheaded Xenas and black Xenas and Asian Xenas and Latino Xenas, Martian Xenas. I mean, it was incredible. And we're just striking out everywhere. Finally, a young producer named David Icke pipes up and says, "What about Lucy Lawless?" And we had used Lucy in some early episodes of Hercules. We said, "Yeah." Well, we shot Hercules and Xena in New Zealand, which is a wonderful place to work. And great crews, great people, interesting scenery. Every time you turned around, you could go shoot a beach scene in the morning and be up in the mountains in the snow in the afternoon. And so we called Lucy, because she was, I think she was panning for gold in Australia or something. She's a native New Zealander. And she said, "Oh, that would be cool." So we hire her, but we don't know what it's going to be like. So I get the first day's dailies. I put them in my VCR. This is in 1995. First show up for the new year. And I see her, and she's riding a horse and swinging a sword, and she spots a band of pilgrims being robbed. And she rides down to their rescue, jumps off the horse, swinging her sword, clocking a stuntman every now and again. You hear guys going, "Ouch!" She didn't know how to pull a punch. I'm not sure she ever completely learned. And I look at her and I said, "My God, she's Xena. She was perfect. She was perfect. I can't tell you. She looked great. She's a strapping woman. Great eyes, beautiful eyes. She's intelligent, well-read, worked hard, no attitude. Just really was a dream to work with." And honestly, I've made more than my fair share of money for Xena coming up as a co-creator with Rob Tappert. But I should probably kick back something to Lucy, because if Lucy doesn't play that part, Xena dies after three episodes of Hercules. But she just owned it. It was a miracle. I've often thought of successful TV and movie ventures as miracles, in some, either in a large way or a small way, and this was in a large way.
Unfortunately, we're coming to the end of our time today, and there is so many things that I want to talk to you about, not only about Lucy Lawless, but how actors and actresses make a production, even though they didn't write it. They just all of a sudden, they create something beyond the script writer, actually, or beyond the creator of the co-creator. But unfortunately, we'll have to do that on another show at some point in the future. So, John Shulian, thank you very much for chatting with us about your life, your fascinating life, and also about the worlds that you've lived in so far, which is sports writing, boxing, script writing, Hollywood, television, all of this. So thank you very much for your time, and we'll be back to you again.
It's been a pleasure, John. Thanks for having me.
The name of our program is With Respect. We're on every week. And remember, our program has a mantra. If you show respect to other people, they will show respect to you.